I'm Allison Keyes. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. And we're talking fashion. From uber skinny men to plus-sized women, the industry is changing. You'll hear from full-figured model Ashley Graham in a minute. She's making waves with a lingerie ad that a couple of TV networks refused to air in its original form. But first, more about the incredible shrinking man. Skinny jeans are all the rage for guys, and apparently bodies that fit into the glove-like get-ups are the next big thing, or really a small thing. A UK-based company will soon debut a new line of male mannequins with a 27-inch waist and a rather, shall we say, gaunt physique. Isn't that too skinny? Let me ask Adam Rappaport, style editor for GQ magazine. He's on the line from his office in Manhattan. Welcome, Adam.
How are you doing?
And I feel like I have to ask, now, what is it you're wearing?
I am wearing matchstick fit jeans from Levi's. They're skinny without actually saying skinny jeans.
These jeans could fit on one of those models, huh?
They might be a little loose on one of those mannequins, actually. They're slim without cutting off circulation, I would say.
Rootstein describes their new skinny mannequin collection as Young and Restless redresses the balance of the prevailing male beefcake figure by carving out a far more streamlined, sinuous silhouette to match the edgier attitude of a new generation. Is a new generation really that small, or are they just wearing clothes that are?
I think they're wearing clothes that are slimmer. I think we unfortunately probably have the same waist sizes we've always had. But you know, you've seen for the last several years the silhouette, as they say in the fashion business, becoming a lot slimmer. Fitted suits, slim jeans, skinny ties. If the 80s and 90s were more of that sort of comfortable Armani suit that is kind of crepey and drapey, now it's all skinny, skinny, skinny. Whether you are or not.
I remember guys used to walk around in pants that were twice their size these baggy shirts. Is that a reaction to this?
It's somewhat. Typically in fashion, you know, the pendulum swings. If everyone's wearing big baggy jeans, then the cool kids want to be wearing skinny tight jeans. You know, once everyone is doing something, the elite want to be doing the opposite. So it swings that way. But what's interesting is how long it takes for the general public to kind of catch on. You know, you were seeing very skinny suits and models that basically look like these mannequins, these very wafy, thin teenage boy mannequins on the runway when Christian Dior's men's line was showing about 7-8 years ago when Eddie Sliman was a designer. And he got a lot of flack at the time for basically bringing out models that were teenage boys with these frail bodies, no hair on their chest, no muscles. And, you know, like I said, that was 7 years ago probably. And now it's kind of catching up more to these big sort of chain stores like Top Man and H&M and Uniqlo.
Isn't that a little creepy? I mean, if you're
30... It is creepy. And especially if you see it as you're sitting there at the fashion shows, you're like, wow, that kid's like 16 years old and hasn't really been eating a lot and certainly hasn't seen the sun in a couple of months. But, you know, like I said, I think the labels, they want to kind of suggest an extreme and then you kind of adapt to part of that extreme. I don't think people are expecting people to be actually this skinny necessarily or this young because if we're not that young.
But if you're a 35-year-old guy and you're looking at wafy guy, are you thinking, okay, I've got to eat a pea a day so that I can fit into those jeans? I think I read somewhere that the largest size some of the newer jeans are coming in is a 33-inch waist for a grown man, really?
Yeah. And not too many grown men I know. Listen, I think the average grown man is smart enough to know what he can and can't get away with. And also, yeah, if you have a wife or a girlfriend and you come home with really, really skinny jeans on, she's going to take one look at you and probably send you home. Now, that said, there is a happy medium. You can wear jeans that are straight leg or slim fit without being super skinny tight like you're in Metallica or something. You can wear suits that actually fit you. And the problem that American men have had for many years is that they're wearing their suits a size or two too big. The shoulders are kind of hanging off. Their pants are too slouchy. They've got the pleated pants that they could fit, you know, two of themselves in. So it's like, all right, you don't need to go to extreme. You know, you're not 17 years old. You know, if you're a 40-year-old guy, that doesn't mean you can't wear jeans that fit well. You can wear a suit that fits well. So it's like, yeah, look at the extreme, acknowledge that it's an extreme, and then kind of approach it without necessarily going all the way.
Really briefly, though, I think I've been reading that male eating disorders are on the rise. Is there any connection there, do you think?
You know, as a style editor at GQ, I'm not really qualified to speak on that. You know, I have no idea, and I don't know if that's you're talking teenage boys or if you're talking grown men. But like I said, to suggest that male vanity is something that's crept up in the 2000s is crazy. You know, you look at Saturday Night Fever with John Travolta and the tight suits and the hair dryers. You look at Cary Grant in the 1950s. Men have always been vain. And whether we're wearing tight bell-bottom jeans or, you know, greasing up our hair in James Dean era, to suggest that all of a sudden now we're concerned with our appearance is pretty naive.
That is Adam Rappaport wearing his matchstick jeans, style editor for GQ magazine. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stick your head out the window on Sunday night and listen carefully. The cheer, or groan, will be the reaction of millions of fans to the series finale of the TV show Lost. NPR's Robert Smith reports that fans are nervous that their obsessive watching could all have been in vain.
If you haven't watched any Lost episodes, it isn't too late. In fact, Aaron Rosenthal and a couple of his friends are sitting out in the streets of Manhattan watching every single episode. How many?
120 leading up to the live finale.
So if you're going to spend 4 days straight watching Lost, that puts a lot of pressure on the finale to pay off.
I will be disappointed if it's not a roller coaster ride, I can tell you that.
Alex Green and Mike Berlin know this roller coaster well. Every fan of Lost has gotten a little queasy from 6 years of twists and turns and time travel loops that have made this show into a nerdy thrill ride. I'll prove it. Let the Lostathon boys recap the show in under 23 seconds. Go!
Plane crashes on an island.
Quicker.
And then a smoke monster comes and starts ripping stuff apart.
Then they find a hatch.
Yeah, we gotta go quicker. Time travel.
Right. Then they find a way off of the island.
But then they all got convinced to come back onto the island and...
Go! Pass.
The island is the energy source for all good and evil on the world.
And then
Spoiler alert. Then
they all lived happily ever after.
Or do they? That's been the big challenge for every story writer through history. How to do happily ever after in a way that seems original and satisfying. Aristotle wrote that a proper ending is one that naturally follows some other thing, but has nothing following it. Aristotle would have loved that fade to black at the end of The Sopranos.
Some of the most famous works of literature, like the Iliad, for instance, just sort of end in the middle of things.
Marianna Togovnik is an English professor at Duke. She wrote a book about how literature wraps things up. In the 19th and 20th centuries, authors preferred that something life-altering happen at the end of a narrative.
So the big three are the death of the character, the marriage of the character, or the character moving on to a different place or locale.
So barring a smoke monster bloodbath or a very special wedding of Kate and Sawyer, a pleasing literary ending for Lost almost demands that some folks get off that dang island. But Time Magazine's TV critic James Poniewozik says a sci-fi mystery show like Lost has to do better than that in its final episode.
Fans look at that not just to give you catharsis. They're looking at it as like the answer to the puzzle. It's supposed to be the thing, the key that makes the other 120 hours you spent watching the series worth it or not.
Talk about pressure. At Professor Tom's, a bar in Manhattan, hundreds of people gather each week to watch Lost. You can tell they're sharpening the pitchforks. Ariel Gonzalez has his personal pride on the line.
I have a buddy at work who's been telling me for probably about the last 6 or 7 weeks that it's all a big waste of time, nothing's going to get answered, and it's just going to be the waste of 6 years.
What do you tell him?
I tell him, shut up, you don't know what's going on.
And yet every person here has some deep fear about what might happen.
The whole it was all a dream thing.
Oh, I hate that.
I would riot.
If they kill everyone off and it ends in this big giant void.
That they're all in hell.
If there is no hero in the end, that would be a cop-out.
The producers of Lost, Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, say wait and see. They've been working toward this ending for years now, and they point out that one of the themes of the show is the power of faith. Of course, another theme of Lost is deception and con artists, so take your pick. But they did send a not-so-veiled message to fans in last week's episode. A woman wakes up on a beach and sees a mysterious figure.
Every question I answer will simply lead to another question.
More questions? Ah, we've been warned. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
In the 1960s and 70s, Cuba's communist hardliners viewed rock and roll, American pop music, and long hair as signs of moral decadence. Well, some things in Cuba have changed since then, and as Nick Miroff reports from Havana, the generation that missed disco the first time can now indulge every weekend.
Ricardo Fragella is a huge, lumbering man with a warm smile and an impressive music collection. His living room is an archive of American pop and rock and roll.
We lost to Fragella from KC and the Sunshine Band.
KC and the Sunshine Band. He's holding this autographed CD case as if it were a bar of gold. The famous disco band sent it to him from Florida after he wrote a fan letter. As a teenager in the late 1970s, Fragella would tune his radio to the faint signals of FM stations out of Miami and Key West. He wrote down Casey Kasem's Top 40 Countdown every week, filling entire notebooks.
De forma legal, no había nada.
It wasn't illegal to listen to that music, Fragella said. We were just decent young people who studied and went to school, and we weren't hurting society in any way. We just loved the music. Fast forward 30 years. On a bright Saturday afternoon in the bar of the Karl Marx Theater, a crowd of 100 or so are here in the darkness, dancing in choreographed rows like on an episode of Soul Train. There's a big disco ball on the ceiling, and music videos pirated from VH1 are playing on a huge TV screen. In the 1990s, at the height of Cuba's post-Soviet economic crisis, communist authorities opened new discotecas all over the country, mostly to appeal to foreign tourists. The venues were too pricey for most Cubans to enter, and they sat empty much of the day. Fragella and his friends had families of their own by then, but their musical tastes hadn't changed, so they convinced some of the state-run club managers to hire them as DJs for afternoon dance parties that would appeal to an older, more Cuban clientele. They called them disco tembas. As disco temba fan Samira Ray has explained it, temba is Cuban slang for a middle-aged person who's a bit past their prime. Pot bellies, wrinkles, a receding hairline, that's temba. It's more a term of endearment than an insult. The disco tembas take place on weekend afternoons, making it easier for parents to get childcare, and they're often over by 9 p.m., so it's not hard to get up for work the next day. Harry Otero is a disco lover and a grandfather.
Aquí ya la gente parece que con un poco de conciencia, por ejemplo, no fuman.
Otero said disco tembas are different from the discotecas that play popular salsa and reggaeton music. People are polite enough not to smoke, they don't drink much, and there are no drugs. We're grandparents now, he said, so we have to set a good example. Otero was there on the balcony of the Karl Marx Disco Temba with Ibis Garcia, a 56-year-old actress with heavy eyelashes and tall heels. She said the music makes her nostalgic, and the nostalgia is what keeps her young.
Esto me mantiene joven porque además lo soy.
This music makes me feel young because I am young, Garcia said. And there are other things that keep me young too, she added with a wink. Like men. How do you like that answer, she asked.
¿Viste que bien te contesté?
And with that, Garcia went back to the dance floor, the Bee Gees, and a party no Marxist could resist. For NPR News, I'm Nick Miroff in Havana.
This week, something new. We call it science diction. It's a little science history, the story of how a scientific word came to be, and what better place to start off our series of science diction with the word scientist. How did the word scientist come to be? Joining us now to talk more about that is my guest, Howard Markell. He's professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He's also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there, and he joins us from WUOM out there in Arbor. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Well, thanks for having me, Ira.
The history of the word scientist is not that old a word, is it?
No, I was really amazed. It's only about 176 years old, to be precise. Came wow. around in 1834, and a Cambridge University historian and philosopher of science named William coined it.
William again? Well, we missed that name.
William Whewell, spelled W-H-E-W-E-L-L, and he was of science. And you know, this was an early point in science, at least experimental science, when a lot of the game rules were actually being developed. So he was really quite an umpire and was consulting with people like Darwin and Faraday and a lot of other prominent scientists that we idolize today.
Mm-hmm. And so how did they get around to using that word?
Well, no one really knew what to call a scientist. There was all these different names like cultivators of science. And
wasn't there natural philosopher years?
Natural philosopher, right. Yes. And so he thought, you know, there's a lot of consilience, another word he came up with, a lot of jumping together of all fields of science, and we ought to come up with a word that refers to all of them. And so he was actually writing in 1834, and he came up with a terms. The first he considered was savants, or men of learning, but he dismissed that for both being presumptuous and French. He was British, as you recall. He also considered the German term Naturforscher, which is really naturalist, but he worried that some might make fun of that term, calling it nature poker or nature peeper. And as you just mentioned, natural philosopher was dismissed because it was simply too wide and too lofty a term. Mm-hmm. But eventually, he came up with, by analogy with artist, that they might word scientist. But he had a few qualms about that because it was close to a few other words that were not held in high regard. The first was economist. That may still be true to this day. And the other was atheist, which was a real problematic term back in those days. But he came back to it nevertheless, and he said, you know, I think this is the word. A cultivator of science in general ought to be called a scientist, and a review of his work in Blackwell's magazine later on that year in 1840 described it even better. They said Leonardo da Vinci was mentally a seeker after truth. He was a scientist, while Correggio, who, as you may recall, liked to play with lightness and darkness, so the size of body parts, was an asserter of truth. He was an artist.
Hmm. How did he get to be friends with all those famous people? Faraday, Darwin.
Well, he was the master of Trinity College at Cambridge, so he had a very good position. He was also a fairly good scientist in his own right. He was a mineralogist. He wrote about geology. He wrote about oceanic tides, mathematics. So he was around, and he was actually writing a book that became very well known, The Philosophy of Inductive Science at this time, where he was trying to set up how do you come up with a hypothesis? How do you prove it? Should it be universal? And, you know, this all seems, you know, so basic to us today, but case back in 1830s, 1840s, when real science as we understand it was just being laid out.
1-800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to talk with Howard Markel about the origin of the word scientist. Howard, how do you come up with this stuff?
Well, I'm afraid to tell you because it's so easy. You may not ask me to come back. When you want to look up a word, any word, in English language, the best place to start is the Oxford English Dictionary because it not only gives you definitions of the word, but it tells you every point in English history where it first appeared.
Yeah.
Got to look it up. But that's the fun of it because you never know what you're going to find, and it's always something good. And you find all these connections. And so finding out about that scientist was a relatively new word led to Whewell's works, and then it led to me finding about who his friends were and so on. I even learned that he died, unfortunately, falling off a horse at the age of 71. But it's really just, you know, you start with that Oxford English Dictionary and you're off to the races. And so, you know, it's so much fun looking up things. So I hope the listeners want to do that as well.
You know, it seems like there was a sort of an evolution. The first words that you mentioned were ended in ER, nature poker, nature peeper, natural philosopher. And now it seems like you take the words and you put an ist, a scientist, naturalist, you know, biologist.
Geologist.
They just decide, well, we're going to go with that kind of ending. We'll take the same things, the disciplines that these people do, and we'll just put an ist on it instead.
Well, what's really neat is that it all comes from the word artist. And, you know, often there's great art and great science, just as there often is great science and great arts. I think it's a really neat coming together of the. Mm-hmm.
Is there another source that's just as good besides the OED? Maybe other sources. I mean, is the internet? The internet must serve now as a great source to find the history of all these words.
Well, the internet is wonderful because once you find all, and you can do this on internet, you know, services as well. Then you can find the books without even, God forbid, going to the library at all. You can actually find the books on the internet. And that's really quite easy, too. So you can do it really from your home.
Of course, you always have to, as everything in the internet, you have to watch out for the source.
Right. Absolutely. You don't want to go to Bob's really cool word site as opposed to the Oxford English Dictionary. So you want to weigh your sources just as you would between bound covers. Mm-hmm. You can't necessarily judge a book by its cover, and you can't mm-hmm. judge an internet source by its webpage.
What other juicy words are you investigating now?
Well, we're working on a few. X-ray is really a fun term. You know, we talk about it, but where did that come from? But what would really be great is if the listeners try to come up with their own words of what they want to find out, and I'll be happy to look them up for you. But there's so many terms in science that we can find out together. Also in medicine as well. You know, the sky is really the limit. But we can find out also fields about, for example, orthopedics, the bone doctors, you know, doctors of broken bones. That comes from bent bone, which often had bent bone. We're born with birth defects.
We're talking. Let
so
me
one
just,
thing leads to another.
Yeah. We're talking with Howard Markel this hour on Science Friday from NPR. There's nothing wrong with your radio. Hear little dropouts. That's because we're in the digital age, and digital lines are sometimes a little finicky as they try to get all those packets to go to the same place at the same time and put themselves back together. So if you hear a little dropout, please hang in there with us. And I guess new scientific terms, Howard, are now being born all the time as we have new disciplines coming up.
Yeah, you know, the technical term for that is neologism, where you combine two different to come up with a new meaning. It also, as I recall from my medical school days, is a sign or symptom of schizophrenia. So you have to be careful about the new words that you invent. But, you know, we're doing this all the time when we come up with, you know, blog, weblog, or right. website, or all these kinds
tweet,
of things.
Tweeting as, or
tweet.
Twittering.
Yeah. yeah.
Or, but even new disciplines that were not around years ago, like nanotechnology.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's what's so great. I mean, linguists always talk about how language changes with each time period, but I don't think anywhere more true anywhere than in the world of science and medicine. Yes,
are there words that are just no longer used anymore? That science words that were in common in the common vernacular that you never hear anymore.
Well, you brought up naturalist, for example,
right.
which was a very popular word. I remember the first time I saw that was reading Dr. Doolittle books. I don't think anyone reads him anymore.
Danny Gunn.
You may recall.
That's right.
He was a naturalist. And there's all sorts of medical terms as well, or spellings of terms, like surgeon, chirurgical. With a CHI was the older term for surgical. Physic.
Oh, that's right.
Physics,
that's right.
But it means an internist or an internist specialist. You deal with the internal part of the body.
Mm-hmm. And even the spelling of things, right? Just the spelling
yeah,
of things.
Yeah, they change too.
Yeah. And so what's the biggest challenge then for someone who wants to follow words, for a historian? Is it finding resources to find out who was first? Because I know in science, one of the hardest things in science is when you discover who you think was the first, there's always someone who was firster before that one.
And I've learned long historian never to say anyone was first because I automatically get a call or an email or a letter saying, no, so. But you can get an approximation. What the Oxford English Dictionary does in terms of first is that they use the first time
right.
it appeared in print.
Yeah. Well, so. given the state of our phone line, I don't want people to keep filling in the blanks, Howard. I want to thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. Thank you very much. We'll continue with our series of Science Diction page. In fact, if you have an idea or word you'd like to hear in Science Diction, leave a comment on our Science Diction page at sciencefriday.com. We'll shoot them over to Howard, and Howard can help us find some words for you. So thanks for being with us today, Howard.
Well, thanks so much, Ira.
You're welcome. Howard Markel is professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He's also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there, and he joins us from WUOM in Ann Arbor. That's about all the time we have for today. Surf over to our website. If you want to leave us a science fiction word while you're there, you can also look at our video pick of the week, Flora's video pick of the week, the red-eyed tree frog. Great little frog that's shaking up the branches out there. Also, take our survey. We have a new survey. We want to know about who you are, whom you are, whichever is grammatically correct. And so just click on the button. There are just a few questions. We'll ask you about what you like, what your preferences are, how you like Science Friday, where you hear it. Click on that, and we'll take that little survey. And you can also take Science Friday with you on your iPhone app. Click on there and go to iTunes, and You can also leave us some email there, or you can send it the old-fashioned way. But go to our website. Everything is there in one spot. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.